Hare Krishna. Thank you for coming today morning, and we'll be continuing this discussion on responsible relationships. How many of you were there yesterday evening? Okay, thank you. So yesterday I spoke three main points. I started by, when somebody hurts us, rather than focusing on why are they hurting us, we can ask, how are they themselves hurt, because of which they are hurting. The topic was, hurt people hurt people. The second point was that when we try to understand people, that doesn't mean we excuse them, because sometimes in the hurt they may be acting with excessive force, disproportionately. And we can separate understanding and excusing, so that we don't block understanding in the fear that, okay, I'll have to overlook everything that they're doing. We understand. And lastly, I discussed about how intelligence means that we are able to respond, we act, we acknowledge our emotion, but we don't act according to our emotions alone. We act according to how best we can serve Krishna. With spirituality, we can strengthen our intelligence. So, the second session which I'll speak on today is acting according to our values. That was the originally I had planned a second session, but I'll take that in the third session in the evening today, because that is more broad and more relevant. Today I'll speak a little more philosophically, because it's a morning. I told all of you, the most serious devotees here. So I'll take a little more conceptual analysis in terms of understanding this from the three modes perspective. So the theme I'll take is the third session, that make judgments but don't be judgmental. That means make judgments. Say, for us to do any activity in life, we need to make judgments. Say, if we are driving a car, and then we see another person is driving a car from the opposite side, and there is a small space. Now, can I go through this space? That requires a judgment call. Now, sometimes, if the opposite person, we see that that person is driving in a very shaky way. They don't have the car in control. Maybe they are a little inexperienced, or maybe they are intoxicated, or whatever. Then, normally we might be able to drive the car through that space. But in that case, maybe let me wait. Let the person pass on. And then I will move. So making judgments is simply a functional requirement. In every walk of life, say, if we have to carry a lot of luggage, and when we come to the airport, say back to go back to India, then we may decide, okay, can I carry this luggage myself, or do I need a trolley? Or do I need a porter? What is the word for porter here?
Porter
itself? Okay. So, it's in America it is porter, India it is coolie. So, words are different in different places. I was in America and somebody had asked me how I was introduced to Krishna consciousness. So, I started speaking and I said that, so after I passed out from my college. Now, in America, passed out means to fall unconscious. I passed out. So, I graduated from my college. So, words can have different meanings in different contexts. Anyway, so in this, do I need a porter? Or do I? So, that is quite a judgment. Suppose if we have some back pain and we try to lift too much of a weight, then we will hurt ourselves. So, making judgments is a functional necessity. But being judgmental means that we fix labels on people. We fix labels on people. What kind of labels? This person is lazy. This person is short-tempered. This person is forgetful. This person is arrogant. This person is ignorant. So now, this kind of labels, when we fix on people, we may feel that is also a functional requirement. That's not exactly true. at one level, we have to take judgments also. Say, if we are talking with somebody who is, say, if we are South Indians, and then we are talking with somebody who is North India, we cannot talk in Tamil or Telugu or Kannada. We have to make a judgment. Okay, this person is from this part of the world. Let me talk in Hindi or English. So, to some extent, when we meet people, we have to classify them. Okay, this person is American, so I'll have to speak in English. So, that kind of classification is a functional necessity. But when we are talking about labeling over here, it happens when we reduce a person to a particular behavior. And when we reduce people to their particular behaviors, then we can't develop a personal relationship with them. Our relationship becomes reduced to their that particular personality trait. Now, that personality trait may also be a reality. But that person is much bigger than that personality trait. When we form judgments on people, the result is that often they themselves become reduced in their own conception also. They start thinking, okay, everybody thinks of me to be like this. And they also can't break free from that box into which we have put them. So why are we talking about this in terms of responsible relationships? Yesterday I talked about hurt people. So when we find that somebody has hurt us in some way, this person has forgotten something, some person has become angry with us, the person has become lazy and not done certain things. So we based on that, the hurtful experiences that we have had, we form some labels for them. This person is like this. And then when those labels come up, the result is that we ourselves can't see that person anything separate from the label. So in America, I had several places I spoke to mental health care centers at one, and there especially a big problem is addiction, drug addiction. Is it a problem here also? It's here also. Everywhere almost. Yeah, so a huge problem. So now there have been different approaches tried out for dealing with addiction. And one of the approaches that has worked best is in Portugal. So Portugal had almost 50 to 60% of the population was drug addicts in 2000. And then they found that although they were trying in various ways, the drug addiction was increasing. So they completely changed the approach and they said, rather than focusing on criminalizing addicts, let us focus on integrating addicts into society. That means much of the money that they were spending in trying to punish people who were drug addicts, they started using that to rehabilitate drug addicts. Give them education, help them to earn a living. And eventually they said that normally no employer would want to employ anyone, somebody who is a drug addict, because they may contaminate others, they may behave responsibly. But the government said that if you employ this person, then we will pay half the salary. So the government tried to help in integrating people by giving them a life worth living. And the result was, today in the Western world, Portugal has the world's least addiction rate. And so now experts say that the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. Sobriety means you're no longer addicted. They say the opposite of addiction is connection. If a person is connected with various aspects of their life, they have friends, they have family, they have a job, they have something by which they are making meaningful contributions in their life, then they outgrow the addiction. So the conventional approach was, oh, this person is alcoholic, this person is a drug addict. And in fact, the previous approach was that a person would be labeled, and when they would be labeled like that, in anywhere they go, their first identity would be this person is a drug addict. And that would perpetuate the addiction. So of course, no approach will work all the times. And ultimately we understand this connection is ultimately the connection with Krishna. I'll come to that later. But the point I was making over here is that if we become judgmental and fix labels on people, then people continue to behave like that. But when we start seeing people as bigger than their labels, so what the government did over there was, let them live a normal life and help them to live a normal life. Help them to outgrow that label. And the result was that they were able to integrate themselves into society much better. So we need to make judgments, but we shouldn't be judgmental in terms of affixing labels on people and reducing people to those labels. Any questions or comments at this point?
When we have a person with addiction, how do we know it? Internally, the impression he's a drug addict is very strong in us. Or an alcoholic or any other bad habits. Our own mind has to be treated instead of looking at the other person. How do we treat our mind?
Okay, good question. So, in fact, this question is what I was going to talk in the next part. So, okay, so, if we in principle understand that, okay, I don't want to reduce a person to a particular label, then how do we go about doing this? So, this is where the three modes of material nature come into the picture. In the Bhagavad Gita, from 18th chapter, text 20, 21, 22, Krishna talks about perception in the three modes. Or knowledge in the three modes. So how do we look at things? And he says, let's start from Tamoguna, then we'll move to Rajoguna, and then into Sattvaguna. So in 18.22, he talks about perception or knowledge. Knowledge here refers to how we look at the world, how we take in information from the world. 18.22 he says, Yattu krutsnavade kasmin karye saktam ahaitukam atatvarthavadalpamcha tattamasam udaharutam. Says yattu krutsnavad ekasmin. And we take one thing and make it into everything. Krutsnavad is everything. Ekasmin is one thing. When we take one thing and make it into everything. Yattu krutsnavad ekasmin. Karye saktam ahaitukam. That such people get attached to one thing only and ahaitukam. They don't consider the cause-effect connection. Just ahaitukam here is just a fragmented vision, just obsessed with one thing. Atattvarthavad alpamcha. Atattvarthavad. That means we don't understand the complete reality. Tattva. What is the reality? We don't understand it. What do we understand? Alpamcha. A meager knowledge is there. Very small aspect of reality we know. And we think that is all that there is. Tad tamasam udharatam. That is, Krishna says, knowledge in the mode of ignorance. So essentially, when we take one thing to be everything, that is knowledge in the mode of ignorance. And in Tamaguna, we catch, this can happen, this can apply to various things with respect to relationships. We catch one aspect of a person and we equate the person with that alone. Now this can happen in various ways. Say for example, in the Western world there was racism, where a person was reduced to just the color of their skin. In India there was casteism. This person is reduced to just their birth. Now yes, people's color of skin is one part of their identity. People's birth is one part of their identity. But to reduce people to that is tamoguna. So in tamoguna, basically, we are very attached. Now of course, the addict's behavior is also in tamoguna. The addict's behavior is what? They are attached to one substance and for that, they are ready to do anything and everything. They forget their responsibilities, their relationships, their roles in society. They forget financial stability. They forget everything and just get mad in trying to get the object of addiction. So they are of course looking at one thing and making it into everything. But we may also succumb to the same error. We may look at one thing and make it into everything. So in general, when we are practicing bhakti, that is meant to raise our consciousness upwards from tamas to rajas to sattva and then to shuddha sattva. And this happens if we practice bhakti diligently. However, sometimes when we practice bhakti, our bhakti can also increase our narrow-mindedness. Bhakti won't increase our narrow-mindedness. It is our practice of bhakti, the way we conceive and practice bhakti, the way we conceive and practice our particular religious activities, that may increase our narrow-mindedness. I'll talk about this a little later, but let's look at other two modes. Now Krishna says, about the rajoguna, knowledge or perception in rajas. He says, pruthaktvena tu yajnanam, nana bhavan pruthakvidhan, vetti sarveshu bhuteshu, tajnanam vidhirajasam. Pruthaktvena tu yajnanam. And people see that a person's body is everything. Separate. Okay, this is one species, this is another species, there is another species. Nana bhavan pruthak vidhan. So the inner nature, inner essence and the outer body, people equate the two. Vetti sarveshu bhuteshu tad jnanam vidhirajasam. That is knowledge in the mode of passion. So one thing is, many people think that animals don't have any souls. It is only human beings who have souls. In the Abrahamic religions, this is an idea. And that comes because they have a peculiar understanding that only humans are, because only humans are capable of understanding God, therefore the soul exists only in human beings. And then what is the purpose of all other living beings? They are just meant for our gratification. So kill them, eat them. And this is so the animal world, when we don't see them at all as persons in their own right, that is knowledge in the mode of passion. And it's very ironic that in the same Western civilization also, people at one level, they love their dogs. And in fact, there are laws which say that if you have a pet dog, you have to have this long leash to the dog. If the leash is not long enough, then that is cruelty to the dog. And people will take such a dog and then they will go to a Big Mac and eat animal food over there. So it's just, they're not able to connect. At the same animal, similar animal which I am lavishing my love on, I am eating that as an animal has been killed to eat similarly. So there, these people are reduced to their bodies. And this also applies to a very sexualized vision of people, where people just reduce people again to their bodies, their physical gender, physical sexuality, and we don't see them as human beings. In Santo Guna, Krishna says, Sarvabhuteshu yenaikam bhavam avyayam ikshate avibhaktam vibhakteshu tajyanam vidhisatvikam. Krishna says here, we see that all different people are there. Sarvabhuteshu yenaikam. There are many different living beings, but they have something in common. What is that? Bhavam avyayam. They have an indestructible spiritual essence. Avibhaktam vibhakteshu. Although they are all separate, but they are all people like me. They are all souls like me. When we see the essential spirituality in everyone, that is what is indicate, that is what is perception in goodness. So sattva guna, sattva guni jnana means that we can see everybody as spiritual beings. So how does all this apply to us when we practice spiritual life and we are interacting with each other? The soul is always pure. The soul may be covered and contaminated by the conditionings, by the kind of the body and the mind people have. But that soul's conditioning is temporary. Beyond the temporary conditioning is the pure soul. So when some people are more religious than spiritual, when people are more religious than spiritual, then they see the body more than the soul. They see the external more than the internal. And when people are religious but not spiritual, then they can often become causes of conflict among each other. In the Western world, there is a large group of people who call themselves as SBNR. SBNR is, does anyone know? Spiritual but not religious.
Oh, okay.
I'm spiritual but not religious. I don't want to belong to any sect. Their idea of religion is you're dogmatic, sectarian, narrow-minded, ritualistic, fanatical. I don't want to be a part of that. I want to be spiritual. Spiritual means open-minded, wanting to explore, understand like higher truths, be compassionate, be sensitive. So spiritual is considered good. Now, when can we be spiritual? When can we can see the commonality, when we can see the equality, when we can see the universality. Sarva bhuteshu yenaikam bhavam avyamikshate. But when we see the separateness, I am like this, this person is like this, then that when we focus on the difference, that is what leads to conflicts. And so when we are practicing bhakti, we also sometimes we get greater criteria for classifying. Say for example, we are Vaishnavas, that person is a Shaivite, that person is a Shakta. We are Vaishnavas, we are Gaudiya Vaishnavas. We can have not just Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we are actually Gaudiya Vaishnavas who are following Prabhupada Anugas. So this all becomes an identity. We say, okay, now each when such an identity comes up, this identity may be useful for functional purposes. But if that is the label we fix on ourselves and the label that we fix on others, then sometimes our so-called spiritual identity can become a cause of material conflicts. The identity is spiritual, but we are seeing it in a materialistic way. What do I mean by materialistic way? Once a person was frustrated and he went on top of a bridge and he stood near the bridge and he was about to jump and commit suicide. And then another person was walking by, "Hey, don't commit suicide, don't commit suicide." He says, "Why? Why should I not commit suicide?" He says, "No one loves me." What happened? He says, "No one loves me, no one cares for me." He says, "Oh, but Jesus loves you." "Oh, how do you know that?" He says, "I am a Christian." "Oh, okay. I am also a Christian." "Oh, really? Okay, then Jesus loves you." "Okay, which Christian are you?" He says, "I am a Protestant." "Oh, I am also a Protestant." "Oh, very good," he says. "Okay, which Protestant are you?" He says, "I am a Baptist." "Oh, I am also a Baptist." "Oh, excellent. Which Baptist are you?" He says, "I am a Southern Baptist." "Oh, I am also a Southern Baptist." "Very good. Which Southern Baptist are you?" He says, "I am a Reformed Southern Baptist." "Oh, you pagan, jump down and commit suicide."
So, there's so much common. There is Reformed Southern Baptist and there is Southern Baptist.
So, there may be so many common things, but one difference, and then jump down, commit suicide. You don't deserve to live. So sometimes, we may take certain things which differentiate us from people. And we may overemphasize them. When that happens, then we are actually having more of a religious vision. Here the word religion is used in an external sense, ritualistic or external vision, than a spiritual vision. We talk about smartha brahmanas. Smartha means, the word smartha actually originally did not have a negative connotation. Smartha simply means from smriti. Those who follow smriti are called smartha. But many of those people became very ritualistic, focusing only on externals. Oh, you are a low caste, stay low caste. So to be smart is not smart.
to be smart, to just focus on external vision, externals of people, that is not very smart.
So we need to look at what unites us. And there is so much that brings us together. At a spiritual level, you understand no matter how a person may be, that person is a soul, that person is a part of Krishna. And yes, that person has a problem right now. And we have to acknowledge. Say if somebody has been as driven drunk, and then we cannot give them the responsibility of driving. So from a functional perspective, recognizing that certain people may have certain issues, that is necessary. But we don't have to reduce people to that. So that happens when we can see spiritually and understand that everyone is a soul. That soul may be conditioned, but they are conditioned in their way and I am conditioned in my way. Their conditioning may be tamasic, my conditioning may be rajasic or sattvic. But still it is conditioning. So by learning to see the essential spirituality of everyone, actually we can start seeing people as separate from their labels. There are certain characteristics people have, but they maybe have certain deficiencies, some limitations, but beyond it all, they are individuals. When I do corporate seminars or I do retreats, I do an experiment, which maybe you can do later at your home. This is called it as 1 minute eye to eye contact. Just without talking, select a friend and just look at them for 1 minute continuously. It may seem simple, it is not easy. When you just look for 1 minute continuously at someone, just keep looking. Actually, when we unrelentingly look at someone for 1 minute and they look at us, what happens by that? Just by looking in the eyes of someone consistently, we start seeing that actually they are conscious beings. We may not realize, if we don't have philosophical understanding, we may not realize that they are souls. But that this is a conscious person who has emotions, who has personality, who has nature. That this is a conscious being. We often treat people as tools for getting things done. I have to do this and this person can't do this. Do this, this person can do this. So we have often a utilitarian vision of people. And this kind of exercise, if we do it, just without blinking, without looking away, just continuously look, and not in a frivolous way. And generally when we do this exercise, we separate the genders, otherwise something else comes up. So of course if somebody is married, then that's fine, but otherwise just two people, there is it often people after that we have some realizations, you know, what do you feel? And you'll say, I never thought of this person in this way. This person also has emotion, this person also has feeling, this person also has desires. This person is a conscious being. That experience can be quite deep. So basically, by getting a more spiritual vision, we can acknowledge that people have certain limits, certain limitations, certain problems. But we can see them as separate from their limitations. It is a part of them. And I have to acknowledge that. If somebody is not a very good singer, then we can't necessarily give them the responsibility of leading kirtans. But that doesn't mean that they are deficient in any way. So if somebody is short-tempered, then we have to be careful when we deal with them, when we talk with them, that they should not be provoked unnecessarily. So there are some operational precautions that do need to be taken. But while taking those precautions, we don't have to reduce people to their limitations. Okay? Thank you. So, any questions at this point? So, this was the second point I discussed, that by trying to cultivate vision in sattva, we can separate people from their limitations of their behavior. See their spirituality as more defining of them than their particular conditioning or limitation.
Prema, at what stage do we actually get over this problem of perception.
Okay. During our spiritual growth from Shraddha to Prema, when do we get over, when do we rise to perception in Sattva rather than Rajas or Tamas? I haven't seen any correlation technically speaking with respect to this, but broadly, Anartha Nivrutti is where most of the conditionings go down. Therefore, if somebody has come to the eventual level of Nishtha or Ruchi, then they should be able to see things much more spiritually. Now, it's important that we don't again use this to become judgmental about others.
Oh, okay.
That means, that means you are seeing like this, that means you are not a very spiritually advanced person. That can also become like that. So sometimes a person may be very spiritually advanced also, but some anartha might stay for a long time in a person. So some people may, by from their childhood, their upbringing, their past life, they may be very short-tempered. And now they may be very spiritually advanced in other ways. But they may be very sacrificing, very dedicated to the service of Krishna, and willing to go way out of their way to do things for Krishna. But then still they might have that short temper. So that doesn't, just because they have a short temper does not mean their spiritual advancement is undone. So in particular people, certain conditionings may stay for a long time. When we say anartha nivrutti, that doesn't mean all the anarthas go away. That anartha nivrutti leads to nishtha. And that can be correlated with the Bhagavatam verse, nashta prayeshu abhadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavati ruttama shloke bhaktir bhavati naishtiki. So that naishtiki is related with nishtha. So steady firm practice of bhakti. But the pertinent point here is nashta prayeshu abhadreshu. Prayeshu means most. It is not all. So most abhadras, most conditionings go away. But some conditionings may still remain. So rather than, for our own spiritual advancement, we can say that, yes, as I grow spiritually, I should be able to give up this condition. But we don't necessarily have to label people based on their exhibiting certain anarthas. Okay, thank you. Yes, you had a comment or question?
When we actually act based on our perception which we have, because you have certain perceptions. And then will that become judgmental? Because there are certain things which you said, like based on skin or caste or things like that. That's different. But like when you know the nature of a person, and then you actually act based on the perception we have about that person, will that act be judgmental?
Okay, good question. So if we know that a particular person has a particular conditioning, if we know that a particular person is a particular way, then we behave with them accordingly. Is that being judgmental? Judgmental is more an attitude than an action. That means that sometimes by acknowledging a particular person's limitation, we may be doing that in a mode of service. Or we may be doing it in a mode of condemnation. The same action can be done in very different ways. So for example, if say somebody can't do a particular service well, somebody is trying to play some kartal or mridanga and they are making a mess of it, and then we can just go to them and pull the mridanga and kartal from them, and the way we do it can make them feel very bad. Or at that time, say there's nobody to sing and nobody is able to play and they are trying to play, and then we just offer, can I play? And they also know that they are not so good, but they may give it up without making them feel bad. So in communication, when I started learning public speaking, it's told that when you're giving a class, sometimes we may speak some concepts which are very difficult. So there is a way in which you can ask feedback. A speaker should never ask the people, do you understand? He said, do you understand? Basically, what are we doing? We are basically making people feel you are dumb. Why you're so dumb? You don't understand. So there is a speaker that I am here, the audience is here, and there is the concept being communicated. So as soon as we put the onus on the other person, you can't understand. Do you understand? then that makes people feel defensive, and that makes people feel insecure or hurt, uncomfortable at least, if not hurt. So the same thing could be said objectively. Is this clear? So what is happening? I am focusing not on the person but on the subject. Mm-hmm. Or the same thing, if I want to take more responsibility, I can say, am I making myself clear? So what is happening over here? I am taking the responsibility. If I am a speaker, it is my responsibility to make sure that I make things clear. So similarly, when a particular person has a particular limitation, then at that time we can and sometimes we should take that into acknowledgement, take that into consideration when we are interacting with them. But while doing that, it's simple. Say somebody can't speak English very nicely, and then we start speaking in Hindi. Now sometimes it can be done in a very discreet, seamless way where the conversation goes on. Or sometimes some people can make the other person feel, oh, you don't know English? You're such useless. Okay, for you I'll speak in Hindi. Make the person feel inferior about it. So basically, that is bad. So when we do something with an attitude of service, then we can acknowledge the limitation of the person, but we don't make the person feel bad because of that. So behaving with people in a way that takes into consideration their particular limitations, that is sensitive. But so we are being sensitive, but while being sensitive to them, to their particular limitation, we also have to be sensitive to how they will feel about it, and do it in a more discreet way. So that requires some thought about it, but over a period of time we can learn how to do that. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
You mentioned about that Smarta, Vaishnava, Gauri Vaishnava, Rupadamala. In that context, institutionalizing the process of bhakti. Of course, Prabhupada's instruction is there that.
Okay, this is a big question. Can we keep it at the end?
Yeah.
We'll come to that. There's one more point I want to take, and then we'll open the floor for questions. So the first point I made was that make judgments, but don't be judgmental in terms of fixing labels on people. Second point I made is that separate people from their conditionings by seeing that they are souls who are just like us. Third point is that whenever we are dealing with people, before we put them in their place, put ourselves in their place. Instead of putting people in their place, put ourselves in their place. That means that very often when somebody hurts us, our focus goes on how much pain I am in. How could this person have caused this much pain to me? So earlier I started the first session, I said, well, that look at how they are hurting. But here we are going deeper and seeing that if I put myself in their place, then how would this seem? In fact, in conflict resolution, if two people are having an argument, one principle in mediation is that two people, you did like this, you did like this, you did like this. It's just going on and on and on. So when that happens, one thing is that you just tell A and B are having a conflict. Tell A that can you explain how this looks from B's perspective? Now that just forces people to think. If you have to not only think about it, but speak it. And speak it in the presence of B. Okay, I feel you did like this, you did like this, you did like this. But then from B's perspective, we start saying that I have seen this, when we do this, that actually both of them told B, don't criticize the other person, don't correct the other person. So when A starts speaking from B's perspective, and then also when we did not give you this service, you felt hurt because you felt angry because of this. No, I didn't feel angry. I felt lonely. I felt left out. Oh, okay. Then what happens? As people, you start speaking from the other person's perspective, they start also, their focus also changes. What happens if their focus changes means that rather than they trying to prove that they are right and you are wrong, whenever an argument is happening, the whole idea focus is what? That you are a bad guy and I am a good guy. Or even if both of us are bad guys, you are more bad than me. So when that happens, then both of them just keep, they're fighting, but the issue is not being addressed. The human heart needs understanding as much as the human body needs air. Now when we don't feel understood, then we feel choked. Okay, I'm doing this like this, but this person is thinking like this about me. This person is thinking like this about me. This person is thinking like this about me. So when we don't feel understood, then we feel choked. And just like, say, if a person is feeling that I don't have oxygen, then they will do anything and everything. So somehow I have to get oxygen. So they may hit at somebody else, they may try to catch somebody else, pull, do whatever it takes to get oxygen. So when people don't feel understood, then they start becoming like a person without oxygen, start frantically doing anything and everything to gain some understanding. And unfortunately, the more their attempts become frantic, the less people understand them. So somebody is considered to be angry, somebody is considered short-tempered, and they are trying to explain, actually I am not short-tempered, but this is what happened and this is what made me angry. But when they see people not understanding, then they become more angry. Just think, you prove that you are short-tempered. So it becomes very unfortunate. So when, say, the two people are having a conflict, this person is told, explain how this seems from the other person's perspective. Then, when they do that, the other person starts clarifying. This is what I felt at this time. This is what happened at this time. I thought you were doing like this. Then a lot of understanding starts emerging. And in general, people who are actually, most people are not bad people. In fact, ultimately, no one is a bad person. Every soul is a soul who is a part of Krishna. But some people, their conditionings may be so much that they may just habitually act wickedly. So there is weakness and there is wickedness. There is weakness when people, everybody has anger within them. But when they keep getting angry, keep speaking harshly, keep behaving roughly, then that becomes their habitual behavior. And then they might become wicked. So we could say, if there is a mountain or there is a hill, at the top of the hill there is weakness. And when people keep acting similarly again and again and again and again, then that becomes wickedness. Wickedness is at the bottom, where the person just needs to be punished. Then, as in Hindi we say, लातो के भूत बातों से नहीं मानते. So there are many phrases like this. There are many kahavats which you cannot translate into English. If you try to translate this into English, the ghosts of kicks don't learn by words. It doesn't make any sense. Basically, now our tendency is, quite often we try once, twice, thrice, and we don't understand and think this person needs to be punished. लातों के भूत बातों से नहीं मानते, ये सही है, पर हमने बातों से मनाने का प्रयास कितना किया है? How much have we tried? So when we try sincerely, then there are some people with whom, like Duryodhan, he, after all the efforts I explained yesterday, that he was just not ready to listen and he had to be punished. But most people in our day-to-day interactions are not like that. So it is when we try to understand the other person. And when we do that, what happens by that is that once the person feels understood, then their hostility goes down significantly. And then we can actually deal with the issue. So sometimes, so there is an issue and there is the person. And sometimes based on the dynamic of the relationship, a small issue can become very big. And based on the dynamic of the relationship, a big issue can also become very small. Say, it's said that So suppose somebody, we meet a friend after a long time, and then we expect to be hugged. And at that time, suddenly they slap us. That will shock us much more. If somebody whom we know is an enemy, somebody who know that the person is, when we go in front of them, we know they may hit us, physically hit us or verbally hit us. So quite often, in every relationship, we have certain expectations. And when those expectations are frustrated, then after that, even small issues become very big. So when that starts happening, then acting in that relationship seems to be like walking in a minefield. In a minefield, you take one step, boom! So we do one small thing and suddenly people explode. You know, you are like this, you are like this. What did I do? So, in some other relationship, that same thing which we might have done, nobody would have taken it very seriously. Okay, it happens. But here, see, this proves you are like this. So that's how they say. So basically, what we are saying is the issue has to be dealt with. The issues are important. But the issues are, they sometimes become more volatile because of the dynamics of the relationships. So when we try to gain understanding means that we try to see things from the other person's perspective. And there are three broad steps for understanding. One I said is, try to verbalize how it seems from the other person's perspective. Second, the one step before that is, when people want to speak, just let them speak without interrupting. That, it's actually a very, very difficult thing when people are speaking to not interrupt them. No, this is not right. Yes, that may not be right. But if we let people speak, now of course, this cannot be done indiscriminately all the time, because sometimes some people may just go on a tirade for hours. But if we decide when somebody is speaking, because what happens, we may say, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. But what happens if people have 10 conceptions and all 10 add together, then it becomes a terrible conception about us. So we may try to counter, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. But if we allow people to hear, speak, then what happens? They at least feel heard. Once somebody feels heard, that itself decreases the emotional temperature. It doesn't solve the problem, but it decreases the emotional temperature. And so it's not that it may decide, okay, when I am going to speak, you don't interrupt me. And when you are going to speak, I won't interrupt you. And we decide, okay, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you want to make your case, I'll hear you. And the second step I already mentioned. Third step is, with respect to try to gain understanding, is try to visually or conceptually put ourselves in their situation. Say, what I mean by this is, that from our perspective, it might not appear to be a big thing. But from their perspective, it might be a very big thing. What does it mean? Say, a child is walking for the first time. A small baby is getting up and walking. And then while the child is walking, the child slips and falls. And if at that time the mother says, hey, can't you walk properly? No mother will ever say like that. But if a mother says like that, a child will think, I'll never be able to walk. And a child will stop trying to get up. So, we understand, now if somebody who is an adult person is walking in a very haphazard way, and we ask, are you drunk? Walk properly. Now for that person, that statement is not going to affect them so much. If somebody is doing some service for the first time, somebody has given classes maybe 50 times, 100 times, and then we give them some feedback. Okay, at this point you could have spoken this way. But this point was not appropriate for this audience. You could speak like this. Then, in general, nobody likes to be corrected. But for a person who has that confidence, yes, I have given many classes, I can speak, and this person is giving me some suggestion for improvement. I can take that, I'll process it, and I will do it. I'll do it if it makes sense to me. But somebody has given a class for the first time, and then we give them a lot of negative feedback. What will happen? What do you think will happen? Demotivate. And they will think, okay, next class, next lifetime.
I am too conditioned, I cannot give classes.
So there are times when people may commit mistakes, and the feedback, so the same feedback to a seasoned speaker and same feedback to a new speaker, that has a big, big difference. So similar, so that means when we try to understand the other person, that means literally, okay, this, if I had been, say if we are senior, somebody is junior, and we give them some feedback. But that if we think, if 10 years ago somebody had spoken like this to me, how would I have felt? That can make us a little more empathic. So where are they coming from? So when we, in this way, we make judgments, but we don't become judgmental, then we'll find that the conflicts can be significantly decreased, and we can move towards more harmonious, more healthy relationships. So I'll summarize, and then we can have a few questions. I spoke today about how we can make judgments without being judgmental. The first point was that we have to, for functional purposes, classify people, but we don't have to reduce people to their labels. If we reduce them, then they become restricted to that, and our behavior as well as their behavior neither leads to any improvement. Like, as long as drug addicts were labeled as addicts, were labeled as addicts, they continue to be addicts. But when addicts were helped to integrate in society, it's found that they are able to create a better life for themselves. And sometimes our our philosophy may increase our religiosity, by which we may affix religious labels on people, and that may also increase the differentiation. So then second point I talked about is that when we are trying to analyze, when we are interacting with people, at that time we see them first as souls, and then we acknowledge their limitation, but see their spirituality more than their conditioning. To see the conditioning more than the spirituality is material external vision. That is rajas, rajasic or tamasic. But sattvic vision means we see them as souls first. See the commonality and then see the difference afterwards. And last point I talked about is we try to understand the other person. Put ourselves in the other person's place before we put them in their place. For that, first is hear them uninterrupted. Try to verbalize how the thing appears from their perspective. And then think how we would feel if this had happened to us when we were in their position, their situation. That will help us to decrease the emotional temperature in the conflict and help to bring more cordiality and civility in resolving it. So thank you very much. Any questions? Yes, Ru.
For being judgmental, we recite the 10 offenses of the world every day, wherein the ninth spends the faith to instruct the faithless person about the joys of the one name. How do we perceive this?
Okay, so when it says, if we consider that to instruct a faithless person is an offense, so when we are judging somebody as faithless, isn't that also judgment, being judgmental? In my understanding, that offense is simply, it simply means speak to people according to their level. It in a sense, if we take it in a very broad way or in a very literal way, we could say all preaching will be an offense then, isn't it? Because ultimately all preaching is, not in the preachy sense, but in the educational sense, it is meant to give people knowledge by which they'll develop faith. So by default we understand that people are not going to have faith. That's why they are coming, associating with devotees, and they're going to gain faith. But the specific point is the glories of the holy name. So the idea is that everybody is at a particular level in their spiritual life, and we have to speak in a way that helps them rise from there. So there's a conversation of Prabhupada where some devotees asked Prabhupada that in the Bhagavatam it is said that Maharaj Ugrasen had some huge number of bodyguards, a very large number. So the devotees told Prabhupada that when we meet with the scholars and we tell the scholars that Ugrasen had so many bodyguards, they start laughing at us. I say, how could so many people have lived in Dwarka? You know, where were their homes? Where were their toilets? So, now Prabhupada could have answered, talking about Krishna's inconceivability. said that Krishna can do anything. But Prabhupada took a very practical approach. He said, among all the thousands of verses in the Bhagavatam, was that the only thing you found to speak to the scholars? We have limited time with people, and we should speak that which is the most relevant and the most beneficial for them at that point. When Prabhupada is asked by a scholar, what is the essence of your message? And Prabhupada quoted 1.9.10 and 9.9.10 in the Bhagavatam. Dharmasya apavargasya naartho arthaya pakalpati naarthasya dharmai kantasya kamo labhaya ismita kamasya na indriya plitir labho jivet yavata jivasya tattva jignyasa naartho yascheya karmabhi. Prabhupada quoted that life and dharma, they are not meant for material improvement. They are meant for spiritual elevation. That's a whole class in itself. But the point was, Prabhupada was clear. This is what he wants to focus on. Even there are some religions which talk about, if you don't have faith in this particular guru or teacher, you'll go to hell. There are some religions which are even more fanatical, and they say, not only are you going to go to hell, we will help you get there faster. But Prabhupada, if you see his general classes, how often does Prabhupada talk about hell? And the descriptions of hell, practically never. Prabhupada's focus was educational. So we want to speak to people in a way that helps them rise from where they are. So we understand what is the level of understanding of this person, and then we speak philosophy accordingly, so that they rise one step up. Okay? Thank you. Yes. Yes, Prabhu.
Two questions are divided to judgmental. So how do we relate judgmental to the Varnashram? The second one is, unless a person understands that he is doing something wrong, he may not correct it. So how we can get
okay. So how do we relate not being judgmental with Varnashram Dharma? Yeah, traditionally Varnashram Dharma was based on understanding people's guna and karma, and thereafter being able to engage them appropriately. Now 5000 years ago also Maharaj Yudhishthir is speaking to Nahusha, and he says that because there has been so much intermixing through marriage, so determining Varna is very difficult. And we have to look at behavior, we have to look at qualities, and only then we can determine Varna. So the way it happened in the Indian caste system was that people are labeled according to their birth, and that is very damaging, very, very injurious for people's growth, for their contribution to society, and for social harmony. Now, even today, if we want to establish Varnashram. I met several devotees when I was in America. There are students who lived in Gurukuls and they left. And they are now, some of them are practicing bhakti, some of them are not practicing bhakti. I met one person, he is a typical Vaishya, very good businessman. But somehow, when he was in the Gurukul, his teacher thought that he is a Brahmin. And now, of course, what happens? Because Brahmin is considered superior, everybody wants to be a Brahmin. So he also like, oh, I am a Brahmin. And then he had to memorize verses and chant mantras and do puja. And he said, I was so frustrated in my Gurukul. Just left after that. And it took a long time for him to even start practicing Krishna consciousness nicely after that. Now he's practicing, of course. So the point is that it's very difficult to try to categorize people like this. In principle, it is possible. In practice today, because people's own dispositions are also very mixed, and who are the spiritual authorities, they may not be so expert. So the essence of Varnashram is that we work in harmony with our material nature to realize our spiritual nature. This is the essence of Varnashram. What is that? We work in harmony with our material nature to realize our spiritual nature. So that can be done in many different ways in today's world without necessarily having to categorize people into Varnas. The point of Varnashram is not categorization. The point of varnashram is compatible engagement. So if somebody is good at say graphic design, and then we tell them they come to the temple and we engage them in making posters, making various attractive things in the temple, that is the application of varnashram. If somebody is good at decoration and then we ask them to decorate the temple, decorate the deities, dress the deities, that is varnashram. If somebody is very good at business, then we make them in charge of raising funds for the temple. That's varnashram. So we don't have to classify people into boxes. The point is that we engage them in a compatible way. So I'll give an example to illustrate this. See, there is when a plane has to take off. The plane needs a takeoff point. And it needs a proper field from which it can take off. And say if in Mumbai a particular kind of airfield is made, and say in some other city, maybe some small city like say Nasik or some other city where now a big airport is to be made, now they want to make an airfield. Now when they want to make an airfield, the topography, the ground structure of Nasik may be different from Mumbai. And if we start putting in a huge amount of effort to replicate the airfield exactly as it was in Mumbai, in Nasik, that may require so much effort that all energy will go in that only. See, the point is not to recreate the takeoff point. The point is to replicate the takeoff. So in Nasik, according to the topography and geography over there, you might create a airfield that is compatible, that is suitable over there, by which the takeoff happens. So much in what we call as Vedic culture was creating the takeoff point. And the takeoff was the practice of bhakti. So sometimes we may get so caught in trying to reconstruct the takeoff point. We force people, to be a devotee, you have to be like this, you have to be like this, you have to be like this. And yes, in the past people practice bhakti like that. But now, if they're not able to practice like that, well, that's fine. However people are right now, say for example, if somebody is born, brought up in an urban setting, and if they are told, oh, you to practice varnashram, go to a village, and you take care of a cow and plow the land and you practice bhakti. Now, for them, that may be so difficult that they just become disheartened. Now, some people may be fried out with cities and they may be happy to go and live in villages. In general, city life can be quite frustrating, but actually if you go into villages and live in villages, that is a challenge in its own way also. So, is it that somebody has to live in villages and do farming to practice bhakti? No. Somebody can be in cities and they can also practice bhakti that way. So yes, traditionally most of India was agrarian. Most people lived in villages and that's how people practice bhakti. But that was a takeoff point. So the takeoff point doesn't have to be recreated. It is the takeoff that has to be replicated. So therefore, a varnashram, if we try to recreate it, especially in the Western world, now, I spoke at Yale, I spoke at Harvard, I spoke at Stanford. All these three places, one question which came up is ISKCON recommending the caste system? I spoke at, these are not just general classes, these are Hinduism studies classes. And there, the students who had come, they studied a little bit of ISKCON. And they know that Prabhupada talks about Varnashram, the four Varnas. So now in the Western world, if we are labeled that we want to recreate the caste system, with the end of our preaching, the caste system is like one of the worst things that has come out of India. Of course, there have been many much more worse things that have come out in the Western world also. When the Christian Europeans went to America, they didn't just discriminate against the Native Americans; they eradicated them. But somehow there's a story that has come up, and the caste system is considered very bad. And it has been, it's not just considered, it has also led to a lot of atrocities happening. So the point is that we don't have to recreate the take-off point. The point is, the purpose is to recreate the take-off. So wherever people are at, we engage people accordingly and help people to grow towards Krishna. And Prabhupada is expert at that. Traditionally, say example, traditionally women lived in a very protected setting. But when Prabhupada saw American Western women, they were just living like men. So Prabhupada had women go out for book distribution. And they would go alone and talk with people and distribute books. And that's what they were doing before. And Prabhupada did not stop them from doing that. Now, is that ideal? The point is, the ideal is not as important as what is effective. What works for people to help them move towards Krishna. So, for some, in some social situations, for some people, recreating the takeoff may also help. And that can also be done. But we don't have to recreating the takeoff point. That may also help. But that doesn't have to be the primary thrust of our endeavors. So, we have to be very clear that Varanashram is also material. Varanashram itself is not spiritual. The Bhagavatam clearly says that Dharma Sanusita Pamsan Vishwaksena Kathasuya Na Utpadaya Didirtim Shramayevahi Kevala. Now, Dharma Sanusita, when he says that, is referring to Varanashram. Acting according to Varanashram Dharma, if it doesn't increase one's attraction to Krishna, then that's a waste of time. So, at least this young man whom I met, his forcing him to act like a Brahmana, it actually created resentment for Krishna Bhakti in his heart. So it was Shramayevahi Kevala. So if trying to impose Varanashram in society, that makes people resentful, then that is unhealthy. So Varanashram broadly means engaging people in a way that harmonizes their material nature with their realization of spiritual nature. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
But it's more of the addiction of labor. Varanashram is more of the addiction of labor.
Oh, of course.
It's actually the condition of the society which is spoiled.
Yeah, okay.
Blacksmith is more useful to the society than a goldsmith. But the society sees goldsmith as a more useful person and he's better than
that's
society.
True.
So it's a condition of the society.
See, Varanashram is definitely a division of society, a division of labor basically. And it is social perception that has made certain things distorted. That is definitely true. Now, the division of labor will organically also happen. Even now there are people who work intellectuals, there are people who are administrators, there are people who are business people, there are people who are general assistants workers. So that kind of, at a functional level, this division naturally happens in society. So that is essential. Society cannot live without that. But what we are talking about is consciously categorizing people in that particular way. So that is something which is... And when that categorization happens also, okay, this is higher, this is lower. That also can become very discriminatory.
Good point.
Yes, Prabhu?
In the episode of Ramayana, the washerman was judgmental for Sita. One day when he spoke to Ram, and Ram made a judgment based on somebody being judgmental and actually leaving Sita to the hermitage. So how do we understand the entire this episode from the point of view of today's topic of being, judgment, taking judgments, not being judgmental, and somebody like Lord Ram himself passing a judgment based on somebody who's being judgmental.
Okay. This will have to be the last question because I'll require at least 10 to 15 minutes to answer this question. So, should I take this in the evening or should I take it now?
Evening.
I'll take it. It is an important question. I'll try to finish the class early. Let's address it in the evening. Okay. Actually, I have a book on the Ramayana which is hopefully come out from the legal thing. In that, the last article is on this only, Sita's Exile. So, we'll talk about it. It's a new book that has come out. So, till what time, Prabhu?
Yeah, in that, can we also address this from Lord Rama's point? From Lord Krishna's point, ye yadamam prabhutanta bhajamya, as one surrender unto me, I reward them according to the same way. In relationships, also, the reciprocation depends how one approaches and...
That is true.
Yes.
I'll address that anyway. Thank you. Yes. So, till what time should we go on, Prabhu?
Yeah, we can come through.
Okay. So, if you have any more questions, first of all, how many people have questions right now? One,
Okay, one person only. So we'll talk. We'll talk one to
one. One more.
Two. Okay. So maybe the.
This question. You are coming in the evening or no? You are not sure the last question.
Okay. So now why I was asking about questions is that maybe we will have a fourth session on Sunday, tomorrow, isn't it? Day after tomorrow, yeah, the Friday, sir. So that time we can have a major passing for question answers also. I'll just speak maybe half an hour. So if any of you have any further questions, you can write them down also. And you can give the questions beforehand. And if we can discuss. Yes, last question.
You mentioned about the takeout point. What is the essence? You mentioned earlier that this is a place for senior, more committed devotees. I don't fall in that category. But I want to understand, when you say bhakti, what is the takeout point for bhakti? What is the essence, like for somebody who's starting off or
okay.
struggling on the way? What is the essence for
okay.
Is it just chanting or what?
So what is the essential points of bhakti that enables us to take off? Okay. So if you consider climbing a mountain, there is the bottom of the mountain, there is the top of the mountain. The bottom of the mountain is material consciousness, where we are caught in pursuing material things. We are believe that just if I get more wealth, I get this car, I get this house, get material things, that will make me happy. And that's my success of my life. So our vision is caught simply in material things. The top of the mountain is spiritual consciousness, where we understand that Krishna is the source of everything attractive. So various worldly things can give me some pleasure, but that pleasure is like a drop, whereas Krishna is like an ocean. So whatever happiness I might get by anything material, I can get all that and more by becoming devoted to Krishna, by learning to love Krishna, by becoming absorbed lovingly in Krishna. So spiritual growth, the whole purpose of practicing bhakti is to rise from the bottom of the mountain to the top of the mountain. To rise from material consciousness to spiritual consciousness. The essence of spiritual advancement. How do we know whether we are advancing spiritually? We can see, what is my definition of happiness? Not in a conceptual, theoretical sense, but practically. What do I believe? If I get this, I'll become happy. So if our definition of happiness is become serving Krishna, loving Krishna, becoming absorbed in Krishna, that is spiritual advancement. So bhakti pareshanubhava viraktir anyatra cha. The Bhagavatam says in the 11th canto that bhakti is a process, and the result of this process is para isha anubhav. Anubhav is experience. Ish is a supreme lord. Para is one who is transcendental. So that lord who cannot be experienced by any ordinary means, we experience him by the practice of bhakti. So we come into a temple, and if we have no bhakti bhav, you see this is nice decorated statues. But in the bhakti bhav, we feel the presence of Krishna. This is sublime, this is so attractive, something very special. And then, when that para isha anubhav is there, that is so captivating, that it's so fulfilling, that viraktir anyatra cha. We become detached from other things. Detached doesn't mean we become irresponsible, reject things. Detached means that we don't depend on worldly things for our pleasure. We understand that there is a better way to live. There is a higher way to happiness. So the essence of spiritual advancement is becoming more and more attached to Krishna as a supremely attractive person and becoming detached from worldly things. So spiritual attachment and material detachment. This is what happens. Just by the practice of bhakti, bhakti practice means we have basically four main things, A, B, C, D we call it. A is association, satsang, like we come here, come to programs here and understand the philosophy, associate with devotees. And association, what happens by that is, we see devotees practicing bhakti enthusiastically, we also start practicing bhakti enthusiastically. B is books. We study books like Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, this Shastra, as Srila Prabhupada has explained, we study them. That helps us to philosophically understand things. So association takes, it spiritualizes our social needs. We need society, but we can have a spiritual society. Books spiritualize our intellectual needs. We need to analyze, understand things, so books help us to understand it. C is chanting, where we do the japa of the holy names of Krishna, we do japa and kirtan,
by which we call out to Krishna and we connect with him. It is a central limb of bhakti. And D is diet and DT. So DT is we make a temple in our own house and we take vegetarian food that we offer to Krishna and then we take his the remnants as prasad. So by doing this ABCD, we can rise up the mountain towards spiritual consciousness. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki Jai Gaur Premanand ki Hare Krishna.
Thank you very much.
Hare Krishna, thank you very much, Prabhupada.